Now, if you think about Cornwall in the 20s and 30s, I always think about Betjeman's Summoned by Bells and his descriptions of going down to Cornwall on holiday and how he would go down on the Great Western Railway. And it would conjure up very specific images in my mind. And I'd like to conjure up some of those now. You were on what was then really the Cornish Riviera. It was a real Riviera, wasn't it?
Well, it was a sunnier period than now, and that's not just because it was my childhood. I think that it's a scientific fact that, well, the Met people will tell you that there was more sun at that period. So I have all those colours very vividly in my mind. The colours of Cornwall have meant an enormous amount to me, and still do, because I don't live there anymore, and I visit it not as often as I would like. But I think that probably those colours which I saw without knowing what I was seeing, that very, very blue, almost Mediterranean side, because our house was overlooking St. Ives Bay, and you know how beautiful it is. So you've got all that wonderful blue, the extraordinary luminosity of the area, and then on the hills and the moors, there was this wonderful gorse colour. And that was what I was brought up with, and I think I still remember it.
I think when people think of the West and things Celtic, they tend to go into a sort of misty romanticism. But the last thing one could say about your music is that it's misty or romantic, in the sense that the colours are very vibrant, the shapes are very clear-cut. Are you suggesting that this is a reflection of what you saw?
Well, certainly with Ianin, I was always likened to Rutland Boughton and his Celtic Twilight. And I objected to this because I didn't like that sort of thing at all. I'd seen the opera in the West End, and I just didn't like it. And for me, Cornwall was a much more vigorous affair, no airy-fairy side to it at all.
When did your musical talent first show itself?
Oh, heaven knows, I have no idea about that. I was brought up with music all around me. In this house that my father had, there was an enormous studio which had been built for one of the St. Ives artists. And you could get quite literally a small orchestra into this great studio. And when my father came back from the wars, every weekend people gathered together and there were trios and quartets and everything. So I just grew up with that around. I grew up with chamber music and I used to creep in and hear all this. All my formative years were listening to chamber music. My father was a very good amateur flute player. My mother played the piano and the violin, viola. And then, all of a sudden, later on, I never wanted to listen to any more chamber music at all because I was seduced, quite literally seduced by the soprano voice and the tenor voice soaring above the orchestra, and I wanted plenty of brass and drums and no more chamber music.
How did you get that experience of orchestral and vocal music?
Well, I must explain. My father was an opera aficionado, and he knew an immense amount about opera, in particular all the early Italian writers, Cimarosa, Pergolesi, and such like people. And he used to say to me, well, these composers, they're just dictionary names, but one day you'll see, my boy, this is all going to be played. I could never make up my mind whether my father was 50 years behind the times or 50 years ahead of the times, but unfortunately he never lived to see the day when these works are being played, as he said they would. However, it wasn't just that he loved these early, very, very early Italian operas. All Italian opera was grist to his mill. And so while I was doing all my conventional studies here in London, with Albert Sammons and Harry Farjon and violin and composition, orchestration, playing the orchestra and doing a lot of chamber music and all that sort of thing, my father would get hold of me and he'd say, right, now, here's a good scene, and he'd take something out of a well, a Restoration play or Elizabethan play, and he said, right, now you set that to music. So I had to do this, and of course I'd very quickly get stuck, and then he said, well, let's have a look and see what Bellini would have done this, or Rossini or somewhere, and that was the way it did. So when it came to actually writing an opera, I knew a little bit about it, and all the time when I was, right from the early days of being a student, my family used to really laugh at me because they said Otello was my Bible. I never went anywhere without Otello. I just adored that score. And also, another thing, my father couldn't play the piano for Toffee. He used to sort of play with three fingers, four fingers. But he could do enough to play the tunes out of Trovatore. So from being a very small boy, I would hear him playing Trovatore, Traviata, whatever it was. So I got all those tunes in my head in the early days. So it wasn't just Mozart and the classics.
Obviously, between you, your father and you, had made a decision that Italian opera was your favourite ethos, as opposed to, let's say, German opera.
Yeah, yeah. We didn't make a decision. We just knew that that was the truth. I took myself off to hear, I think it was, it was Valkyrie. I went there to hear Valkyrie. Great excitement. I thought that this was going to be a wonderful revelation, that something, well, my poor father, he didn't understand that, but I was going to understand it, you know, so a tremendous reputation. I was going to start anew. I was about 16, 17, so this was really going to start something new to me. And I went along. And oh dear, that was one of my early disillusions. I couldn't stand it. So that was the setup with opera.
Although you have said how much you favoured Italian opera and the vocal style, it wasn't long before you started writing symphonic music, orchestral music, pure and simple.
Yes, that is true. The very first works that I've kept are orchestral works.
Well, how did they come about? Because they were all a result of music making in Cornwall, weren't they? I mean, although you came to London, you still maintain a connection with Cornwall.
Oh, yes, yes. We had a home in Cornwall, which we all thought, or my family thought of that as our home. But we also existed for periods in London while we had to study and all the rest of it. But as soon as the terms were over, we made a dash for Cornwall. Well, there was a lot of music going on there. I told you how everybody used to gather in this studio of my father's and play their chamber music. But there was a very excellent amateur orchestra in Penzance. And this had been founded by an extraordinary man. He was a great character, called Walter Barnes. And he played the violin, and he conducted this orchestra. And he was such a forceful personality that he just beat people into playing for him. My father got to know all these people very, very well indeed. And he used to ask Walter Barnes to come to London in the summer, when the Italian opera season was on, and he'd stay for a short period, and these two would go off to Covent Garden. And one year, this was about a year after I'd started really, I'd done my first three symphonies, that's right, I'd just finished doing my third symphony, and Walter Barnes turned up, and he and my father went off, and next morning at breakfast, these two were grumbling away about the state of music in England, and Walter Barnes said, oh, well, you know, there's opera in Italy, and opera in Germany, and opera in France, they all have their schools, but we've got no school of opera, and isn't it terrible, isn't it awful, and these two went on about this. And finally, Walter Barnes said, well, if they can't produce English opera, what about having Cornish opera? Now, you two, you get to work and write an opera. He said, if you write it, I'll get all the people together and we'll do it down in Penzance. So my father said, are you serious? Oh, yes, he said, I will. So he went away, and my father disappeared into his study. And after 3 or 4 days... he turned up, yeah, very, very quick. He turned up with the libretto of Ianin. And Well, then we went down to Cornwall, to Zenna then, a little village, Zenna, and I wandered around the moors, and I looked at the stones, and I saw everything, and everything was very, very vivid to me. I used to have a funny sort of feeling about all those stones. Somewhere near the beginning of the opera.
The thing one could say about your music is that it's misty or romantic, in the sense that the colours are very vibrant, the shapes are very clear-cut. Are you suggesting that this is a reflection of what you saw?
Well, certainly with Ianin, I was always likened to Rutland Boughton and his Celtic Twilight. And I objected to this because I didn't like that sort of thing at all. I'd seen the opera in the West End, and I just didn't like it. And for me, Cornwall was a much more vigorous affair, no airy-fairy side to it at all.
When did your musical talent first show itself?
Oh, heaven knows, I have no idea about that. I was brought up with music all around me. In this house that my father had, there was an enormous studio which had been built for one of the St. Ives artists. And you could get quite literally a small orchestra into this great studio. And when my father came back from the wars, every weekend people gathered together and there were trios and quartets and everything. So I just grew up with that around. I grew up with chamber music and I used to creep in and hear all this. All my formative years were listening to chamber music. My father was a very good amateur flute player. My mother played the piano and the violin, viola. And then all of a sudden, later on, I never wanted to listen to any more chamber music at all because I was seduced, quite literally seduced by the soprano voice and the tenor voice soaring above the orchestra, and I wanted plenty of brass and drums and no more chamber music.
How did you get that experience of orchestral and vocal music?
Well, I must explain. My father was an opera aficionado, and he knew an immense amount about opera, in particular all the early Italian writers, Cimarosa, Pergolesi, and such like people. And he used to say to me, well, these works, these composers, they're just dictionary names, but one day you'll see, my boy, this is all going to be played. I could never make up my mind whether my father was 50 years behind the times or 50 years ahead of the times, but unfortunately he never lived to see the day when these works are being played, as he said they would. However, it wasn't just that he loved these early, very, very early Italian operas. All Italian opera was grist to his mill. And so while I was doing all my conventional studies here in London, with Albert Sammons and Harry Farjon and violin and composition, orchestration, playing the orchestra and doing a lot of chamber music and all that sort of thing, my father would get hold of me and he'd say, right, now, here's a good scene, and he'd take something out of a Restoration play or Elizabethan play, and he said, right, now, you set that to music. So I had to do this, and of course I'd very quickly get stuck, and then he said, well, let's have a look and see what Bellini would have done this, or Rossini or somewhere, and that was the way it did. So when it came to actually writing an opera, I knew a little bit about it, and all the time when I was, right from the early days of being a student, my family used to really laugh at me because they said Otello was my Bible. I never went anywhere without Otello. I just adored that score. And also, another thing, my father couldn't play the piano for toffee. He used to sort of play with three fingers, four fingers. But he could do enough to play the tunes out of Trovatore. So from being a very small boy, I would hear him playing Trovatore, Traviata, whatever it was. So I got all those tunes in my head in the early days. So it wasn't just Mozart and the classics.
Obviously, between you, your father and you, had made a decision that Italian opera was your favourite ethos, as opposed to, let's say, German opera?
Yeah, yeah. We didn't make a decision. We just knew that that was the truth. I took myself off to hear, I think it was, it was Valkyrie. I went there to hear Valkyrie. Great excitement. I thought that this was going to be a wonderful revelation, that something, well, my poor father, he didn't understand that, but I was going to understand it, you know, so a tremendous reputation. I was going to start anew. I was about 16, 17, so this was really going to start something new to me. And I went along, and oh dear, that was one of my early disillusions. I couldn't stand it. So that was the setup with opera.
Although you have said how much you favoured Italian opera and the vocal style, it wasn't long before you started writing symphonic music, orchestral music, pure and simple.
Yes, that is true. The very first works that I've kept are orchestral works.
Well, how did they come about? Because they were all a result of music making in Cornwall, weren't they? I mean, you came to London, still maintain a connection with Cornwall.
Oh, yes, yes. We had a home in Cornwall, which we all thought, or my family thought of that as our home. But we also existed for periods in London while we had to study and all the rest of it. But as soon as the terms were over, we made a dash for Cornwall. Well, there was a lot of music going on there. I told you how everybody used to gather in this studio of my father's and play their chamber music. But there was a very excellent amateur orchestra in Penzance. And this had been founded by an extraordinary man. He was a great character, called Walter Barnes. And he played the violin, and he conducted this orchestra. And he was such a forceful personality that he just beat people into playing for him. My father got to know all these people very, very well indeed. And he used to ask Walter Barnes to come to London in the summer when the Italian opera season was on, and he'd stay for a short period, and these two would go off to Covent Garden. And one year, this was about a year after I'd started really, I'd done my first three symphonies, that's right, I'd just finished doing my third symphony, and Walter Barnes turned up, and he and my father went off, and next morning at breakfast, these two were grumbling away about the state of music in England, and Walter Barnes said, oh, well, you know, the opera in Italy and opera in Germany and opera in France, they all have their schools, but we've got no school of opera, and isn't it terrible, isn't it awful, and these two went on about this. And finally, Walter Barnes said, well, if they can't produce English opera, what about having Cornish opera? Now, you two, you get to work and write an opera. He said, if you write it, I'll get all the people together and we'll do it down in Penzance. So my father said, are you serious? Oh, yes, he said, I will. So he went away, and my father disappeared into his study. And after three or four days, he turned up, yeah, very, very quick, he turned up with the libretto of Ionian. And, well, then we went down to Cornwall, to Zenner then, a little village, Zenner. And I wandered around the moors, and I looked at the stones, and I saw everything, and everything was very, very vivid to me. I used to have a funny sort of feeling about all those stones. Somewhere near the beginning of the opera, the hero, Geraint, he says to the baritone, almost these stones seem to have life for me, you know. And I really felt the same sort of way, that there was something very mysterious up there on those moors. So I wandered around and I collected my tunes, and within 12 months, almost to the day, Walter Barnes came up to London again, and they had their session at the opera. But the night before he arrived, I stayed up till about midnight, I think, to finish the score. I'd done a lot in the year. So then the thing was to get it all together. My father brought in a very, very good traditional producer. A man, he was called Sidney Russell, and he had started life as, I think he started life as a Shakespearean actor. Then he finally had a voice and he became a character tenor. And he ended up as one of the producers of the BNOC, the British National Opera Company. And he was engaged to produce this and to generally manage this. Well, of course, he knew everybody, knew where to get the right singers. And so the thing was done as near as possible in the proper way, due to this very competent producer.
Let's get back to Penzance and the first performance of Yearning. There you were conducting at the age of 21.
Yes, yes, that's right.
And we're talking about 1934.
That's correct. Yes, it was done. The first performance was on the 5th of November, 1934.
Now, who came? The townsfolk or the county folk?
Oh, well, you know, Cornwall is not very great for county folk. It's not one of the shires. it's all very, very different in Cornwall, very different. But the most important person who did come, and that was where we had our second piece of good luck, having roped in a very good producer, our second great piece of luck was that Frank Howes, who was then the principal critic of the Times, and at that time the Times really did count for something.
The Thunderer.
He was down there. Yeah, the Thunderer. It was still the Thunderer. And he was down there on holiday, and he came along to this performance, and he gave us the most fantastically good review. And, you know, we sort of said, well, here's a young boy, out of the blue, he writes an opera as he's been doing all his life, that kind of thing. And then everybody liked it so much, they said, well, we've got to get this down somewhere in London. And this review was really our introductory card, because otherwise nobody would have looked at us. And my father set up a company and gathered together various people who helped to finance it. And we just waited for a theatre, and as good fortune would have it, the Lyceum. That's the old Lyceum, which was Irving's theatre, and which was still a very important theatre in London. And it became available, and we moved in there in June, and we had a double cast with actually three principal sopranos, and it was done every night, plus some matinees. And we had an excellent company. We had a marvellous orchestra, because people don't realise what music in the 30s was really like in this country. There was so little work, very, very little work. And we had a friend who was a flute player. He came from a family, a famous orchestral family, and he knew everybody. And he went around and he collected some of the best players in London. So it was well done. And everything was going fine, and the audiences were getting bigger. And then all of a sudden, there was a most devastating heat wave. And in those days, there were virtually no tourists coming to London. Nowadays, it's the tourists who keep the theatres open, whatever the weather is. But at that time, if it got very, very hot, as it did, well, nobody went to the theatre, and there were no tourists, so the theatres just closed. And there was not enough money behind the company, so we just had to close down, and that was the end of that. Of course, things were not done in the extravagant way that they're done now. Scenery was very simple, and we were criticised for that because it was simple. Nowadays, it would be probably very, very fashionable, because it would be just two or three rocks and a backcloth and a little bush or something, and that was the moor, you know. It was effective, though, very effective, but it was not sufficiently grand.
And in spite of that criticism, people still came.
Oh, yes, yes, because they liked the music and, I don't know, something about it they all liked. And we got so many of the people who were well-known in music and the opera generally, they all came along.
Well, now, who came?
Well, they all seemed to troop in. Beecham came in one evening, and he walked in his usual way that everybody knows about, and there he was. I mean, he really did it. He walked in, and he was stroking his little beard, and sort of said, "Very good, my boy, very good. You keep the interest going throughout the whole opera." That was a terrific compliment from Beecham, I think. And Vaughan Williams turned up, and I was not, well, to put it politely, I was not a lover of Vaughan Williams at that time. Since then, I've grown to admire his music, but at that time, I didn't like it at all. So he marched in, you know, with his great big black farmer's boots on. He didn't change in the evening. I remember seeing him at Queen's Hall, and he used to go around in his tweed coats and his great big enormous black boots. And so he walks in and he says, tisn't fair, you know, I've been trying all my life to write opera. So we had a lot of fun, and then one day John Ireland came along, and of course I'd never met any of these people. John Ireland came in, and he said, yes, he said, there are bits of Stravinsky in that. I said, what? Well, I didn't know the early ballets because, well, The Rite of Spring was only done about once in 12 years, you know, and I'd never actually hit it. But I had seen Stravinsky at Queen's Hall, and this would be, of course, in his neoclassic period. And he was there with Dushkin playing away, and he just sat there with that mask over his face, and from start to finish, it was all at one level. There was never a crescendo, there was no rubato, there was nothing. And that, to me, was the absolute bottom. I thought this was dreadful. That was not music, because I had to have it expressive and singing and all that, so I hated stuff. So I said, what? To John Ireland? What? Stravinsky? No, there's no Stravinsky in that. Oh, yes, he said there is. You know, where you go, you've got that oath scene. That's Stravinsky. He said, that comes out of the sack. I said, you know, the sack? No. Well, you know the sacks, don't you? I said, no, never heard a note. You don't know it? Oh, he said, now, you've got to come round to my studio one evening, and I'm going to play you the sack. So in due course, I went round and we had a nice supper, and then he had a lovely studio at the end of a garden down in Chelsea, and we went along. Now, I could never play the piano. I mean, I never could. I just play a few chords, and it's really very, very elementary. So he sits down at the piano with me alongside, and he gets out Stravinsky's own four-handed arrangement. And, you know, well, I just sort of looked at this, and I'm always very, very slow at reading music. Terrible. However, he managed to make some noises and get something into me to try and explain to me that I'd been influenced by Stravinsky. I couldn't see it. But after that, I had some wonderful, wonderful evenings, because he went through so much of his own music with me. One evening, we spent an evening, when I say evening, it used to go on till about 4 or 5 in the morning. Yeah, quite literally. He was fascinating. And I learned a tremendous lot. I never studied with him properly, but I did learn an awful lot from all the things that he told me. And one evening, one night, we spent studying his piano concerto. And he told me all about it and how he'd written it, so...
Well, John Ireland was instrumental in getting you your BBC debut, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He introduced me to Edward Clarke, who was the Eminence Grise at that time. And he looked at it and he said, yes, he'd play it.
Play what?
My Third Symphony.
And so you did, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra and you at the helm?
Yeah. And with me there, and that was very good, because that it was a fine orchestra then.
So this record-breaking run, because it still holds the record-breaking. It's no, still what the third.
No, that has been slightly exaggerated. It was, I think, in terms of figures, it was the third longest run or something like that. The The number one in this series was The Immortal Hour, and number two was Sullivan's Ivanhoe, and I came a long way, number three.
You must have felt then that you had arrived.
No, I've never felt I arrived. I never will arrive. I don't think so, no. That's not part of my nature. I do grumble very often. I grumble about other conductors. I grumble about performers. But I also grumble about myself. I grumble about myself a lot. So I never felt I'd arrived.
But, George, even the most sanguine view would have to tell you that this is a remarkable thing that had happened. An opera had come out of Penzance by chance, hit London, had a three-week run with all the great names of the day coming.
Yes. Well, I suppose I was probably rather arrogant. In some ways I was very arrogant, and in some way I was humble, because what happened then was exactly the same as happens now. A lot of people went absolutely overboard over this opera. I mean, there were people that we got to hear about afterwards who were coming night after night, or five, six, seven times they would come to that. They just went overboard. There were others who thought that I should go back to school, that I didn't know anything at all, and who really very actively disliked it. And it's exactly the same as happens now.
It does seem, though, doesn't it, that Ian was... that you were kind of destined to write Ian. You had had this rather unusual upbringing. You had a very unusual father who understood opera. You had written a lot of choruses. You had set scenes. You'd done an extremely deep apprenticeship in the setting of drama. Mm. You'd written a couple of symphonies. You had orchestral technique under your belt. And then suddenly, almost as though from nowhere, out comes Ian. Do you think, always want and intend to be an opera composer?
Yes. Yes, I did. Opera was music for me. It was really the only form of music to which I responded wholeheartedly. The other I'd listen to and I'd admire, but that for me was something apart, was special. That was the way music, that was what music was all about. So then I set to work and I wrote The Serf, and that was a very serious, deep sort of a thing. And it was all a bit too much for me, and it was badly produced, and that's another story. And then, after the war, I wrote John Sopman, and everything went wrong with that. Also, for a thousand different reasons, everybody was fighting everybody. My health was still very bad at that time, but I managed to produce the score, and I was totally, completely exhausted. And so I said, right, finished.
And you won't write another one?
Well, you know, it's a big undertaking now, and that I just don't think I could face it. What's more, I'm not very happy about the way a lot of operas are produced now. I think there's too much exaggeration, too much power given to the directors. For me, the power should be with the singers. This was what I was trying to do in all these operas. Right from the very start, the hero, Geraint, he says to the baritone, almost these stones seem to have life for me, you know. And I really felt the same sort of way, that there was something very mysterious up there on those moors. So I wandered around and I collected my tunes, and within 12 months, almost to the day, Walter Barnes came up to London again, and they had their session at the opera. But the night before he arrived, I stayed up till about midnight, I think, to finish the score. I'd done a lot in the year. So then the thing was to get it all together. My father brought in a very, very good traditional producer. A man, he was called Sidney Russell. And he had started life as, I think he started life as a Shakespearean actor. Then he finally had a voice and he became a character tenor. And he ended up as one of the producers of the BNOC, the British National Opera Company. And he was engaged to produce this and to generally manage this. Well, of course, he knew everybody knew where to get the right singers. And so the thing was done as near as possible in the proper way due to this very competent producer.
Let's get back to Penzance and the first performance of Yearning. There you were conducting at the age of 21.
Yes, yes, that's right.
And we're talking about 1934.
That's correct. Yes, it was done. The first performance was on the 5th of November, 1934.
Now, who came? The townsfolk or the county folk?
Oh, well, you know, Cornwall is not very great for county folk. It's not one of the shires. it's all very, very different in Cornwall. Very different. The most important person who did come, and that was where we had our second piece of good luck, having roped in a very good producer. Our second great piece of luck was that Frank Howes, who was then the principal critic of the Times, and at that time the Times really did count for something.
The Thunderer.
He was down there. Yeah, the Thunderer. It was still the Thunderer. And he was down there on holiday, and he came along to this performance. And he gave us the most fantastically good review. And, you know, we sort of said, well, here's a young boy, out of the blue, he writes an opera as if he'd been doing it all his life, that kind of thing. And then everybody liked it so much, they said, well, we've got to get this down somewhere in London. And this review was really our introductory card, because otherwise nobody would have looked at us. And my father set up a company and gathered together various people who helped to finance it. And we just waited for a theatre, and as good fortune would have it, the Lyceum. That's the old Lyceum, which was Irving's theatre, and which was still a very important theatre in London. And it became available, and we moved in there in June. And we had a double cast with actually three principal sopranos, and it was done every night, plus some matinees. And we had an excellent company. We had a marvellous orchestra, because people don't realise what music in the 30s was really like in this country. There was so little work. Very, very little work. And we had a friend who was a flute player. He came from a family, a famous orchestral family, and he knew everybody. And he went around and he collected some of the best players in London. So it was well done. And everything was going fine, and the audiences were getting bigger. And then all of a sudden, there was the most devastating heat wave. And in those days, there were virtually no tourists coming to London. Nowadays, it's the tourists who keep the theatres open, whatever the weather is. But at that time, if it got very, very hot, as it did, well, nobody went to the theatre, and there were no tourists, so the theatres just closed. And there was not enough money behind the company, so we just had to close down, and that was the end of that. Of course, things were not done in the extravagant way that they're done now. Scenery was very simple, and we were criticised for that because it was simple. Nowadays, it would be probably very, very fashionable, because it would be just two or three rocks and a back cloth and a little bush or something, and that was the moor, you know. It was effective, though, very effective, but it was not sufficiently grand.
And in spite of that criticism, people still came.
Oh, yes, yes, because they liked the music and, I don't know, or something about it they all liked. And we got so many of the people who were well-known in music and opera generally, they all came along.
Well, now, who? So, who came?
Well, they all seemed to troop in. Beecham came in one evening, and he walked in his usual way that everybody knows about, and there he was. I mean, he really did it. He walked in, and he was stroking his little beard and sort of said, Very good, my boy. Very good. You keep the interest going throughout the whole opera. That was a terrific compliment from Beatrice, I think. And Vaughan Williams turned up, and I was not, well, to put it politely, I was not a lover of Vaughan Williams at that time. Since then, I've grown to admire his music, but at that time, I didn't like it at all. So he marched in, you know, with his great big black farmer's boots on. He didn't change in the evening. I remember seeing him at Queen's Hall. He used to go around in his tweed coats and his great big enormous black boots. So he walks in and he says, "'Tisn't fair, tisn't fair, you know. I've been trying all my life to write opera." So we had a lot of fun. And then one day John Ireland came along. And, of course, I'd never met any of these people. John Ireland came in and he said, yes, he said, there are bits of Stravinsky in that. I said, what? Well, I didn't know the early ballets because, well, The Rite of Spring was only done about once in 12 years, you know, and I'd never actually hit it. But I had seen Stravinsky at Queen's Hall, and this would be, of course, in his neoclassic period. And he was there with Dushkin and playing away, and he just sat there with that mask over his face, and from start to finish, it was all at one level. There was never a crescendo, there was no rubato, there was nothing. And that, to me, was the absolute bottom. I thought this was dreadful. That was not music, because I had to have it expressive and singing and all this, so I hated stuff. So I said, what? To John Ireland? What? Stravinsky? No, there's no Stravinsky in that. Oh, yes, he said, there is. You know, where you go, you've got that oath scene. That's Stravinsky. He said, that comes out of the sack. I said, you know, the sack? No. Well, you know the sacks, don't you? I said, no, never heard a note. You don't know it? Oh, he said, now, you've got to come round to my studio one evening and I'm going to play you the sack. So in due course, I went round and we had a nice supper, and then he had a lovely studio at the end of a garden down in Chelsea, and we went along. Now, I could never play the piano. I mean, I never could. I just play a few chords, and it's really very, very elementary. So he sits down at the piano with me alongside, and he gets out Stravinsky's own four-handed arrangement. And you know, well, I just sort of looked at this, and I'm always very, very slow at reading music. Terrible. However, he managed to make some noises and get something into me to try and explain to me that I'd been influenced by Stravinsky. I couldn't see it. But after that, I had some wonderful, wonderful evenings because he went through so much of his own music with me. One evening, we spent an evening, when I say evening, it used to go on till about 4 or 5 in the morning. Yeah, quite literally. He was fascinating. And I learned a tremendous lot. I never studied with him properly, but I did learn an awful lot from all the things that he told me. And one evening, one night, we spent studying his piano concerto. And he told me all about it and how he'd written it, so...
Well, John Ireland was instrumental in getting you your BBC debut, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He introduced me to Edward Clarke, who was the Eminence Grise at that time. And he looked at it and he said, yes, he'd play it.
Play what?
My Third Symphony.
And so you did, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra and you at the helm?
Yeah. And with me there, that was very good because it was a fine orchestra then.
So this record-breaking run, because it still holds the record-breaking, it's no, still what the third.
No, that has been slightly exaggerated. It was, I think, in terms of figures, it was the third longest run or something like that. The number one in this series was The Immortal Hour, and number two was Sullivan's Ivanhoe, and I came a long way, number three.
You must have felt then that you had arrived.
No, I've never felt I arrived. I never will arrive. I don't think so. No, that's not part of my nature. I do grumble very often. I grumble about other conductors. I grumble about performers. But I also grumble about myself. I grumble about myself a lot. So I never felt I'd arrived.
But George, even the most sanguine view would have to tell you that this is a remarkable thing that had happened. An opera had come out of Penzance by chance, hit London, had a 3-week run with all the great names of the day coming.
Yes. Well, I suppose I was probably rather arrogant. In some ways I was very arrogant, and in some way I was humble, because what happened then was exactly the same as happens now. A lot of people went absolutely overboard over this opera. I mean, there were people that we got to hear about afterwards who were coming night after night, or 5, 6, 7 times they would come to that. They just went overboard. There were others who thought that I should go back to school, that I didn't know anything at all, and who really very actively disliked it. And it's exactly the same as happens now.
It does seem, though, doesn't it, that Ianin was... that you were kind of destined to write Ianin. You had this rather unusual upbringing. You had a very unusual father who understood opera. You had written a lot of choruses. You had set scenes. You'd done an extremely deep apprenticeship in the setting of drama. Mm. You'd written a couple of symphonies. You had orchestral technique under your belt. And then suddenly, almost as though from nowhere, out comes Ianin. Do you think, always want and intend to be an opera composer?
Yes. Yes, I did. Opera was music for me. It was really the only form of music to which I responded wholeheartedly. The other I'd listen to and I'd admire, but that for me was something apart, was special. That was the way music, that was what music was all about. So then I set to work and I wrote The Serf, and that was a serious, very serious, deep sort of a thing. And it was all a bit too much for me, and it was badly produced, and that's another story. And then, after the war, I wrote John Sopman, and everything went wrong with that. Also, for 1,000 different reasons, everybody was fighting everybody. My health was still very bad at that time, but I managed to produce the score, and I was totally, completely exhausted. And so I said, right, finished.
And you won't write another one?
Well, you know, it's a big undertaking now, and that I just don't think I could face it. What's more, I'm not very happy about the way a lot of operas are produced now. I think there's too much exaggeration, too much power given to the directors. For me, the power should be with the singers. This was what I was trying to do in all these operas. Right from the very start, I was trying to express the drama through the voice, not just through something in the orchestra. In fact, I think that, or it may have been Frank Hauser, one of those critics at the time when Ian was played, they noticed that I was delineating the character of the part by the actual melodic line. This was what I was seeking to do. I was trying to get the meaning and the character into the vocal line, not just some expressive sound coming out of the orchestra with the voice declaiming it. I was developing that way, and that's what I'd hoped to do.
Unfair question, perhaps, but perhaps there's an interesting answer. Are there parts of Ianin that you would want to revise, look at again in the view of your later experience?
Well, I don't think I could rewrite it. When we did it together with the BBC, Chris, I had to study it very, very deeply, because I have to study my own works as if they were somebody else's works. So I started really studying that. And I thought, oh, my God, this is thin, you know. Why do I just have these poor, a very wretched accompaniment or something, you know, because I've been writing so much more richly for the orchestra since then. Oh, this is terrible. But after a while, I said, no, don't touch it. Leave it absolutely as it is, because it had at least I think it has a sort of freshness which can only come from a young, inexperienced person. There are things I know you can look at them and say, well, that's not very well handled and the orchestra's not very good, but I've never changed it. The only things from the original score, when it went into production, we found there were certain little places at Penzance, we found, we'll cut out three bars there because when somebody's coming in, just goes on. There were a few little places like that, and we changed all those. Eventually, I tidied up the score. And when I came to study it with you, the score was precisely the same, except for some dynamics. I'm always changing the dynamics, and that's a natural thing to do because the sound of the orchestra has changed so much. The modern orchestra is so different to what it was in 1934.
What's your favourite thing in this score, the passage you're most proud of?
Oh, my goodness, I shall have to think about that. I rather like the whole end. I think the end of it has a certain sort of magic. And so I'm rather, I like that.
Did that come to you wandering among the stones?
So much of it did, yes. I really lived and breathed this opera, you know, in a way perhaps I've never done with anything else. It was really part of me. And all that, very unconsciously, which I think gives a certain vivacity and a certain something to it.
Truth.
Certain truths, yes, perhaps that's it. And that you can't find again when you reach my advanced age. It's gone.
Well, I was coming to that, George, because it must have been knowing what a lot of people know of what you've gone through since writing and doing Ian in for the first time, the disappointment at Covent Garden, the disaster of the war, the health problems after the war and the problems surrounding John Sockman and your eventual virtual retirement from the musical scene. You came back, you surprised the musical world, delighted the musical world. You came back in the late 60s, early 70s, and brought back something from pre-war England that we'd all forgotten about. And then this, for me, wonderful thing that you came back to direct Ian in, to conduct Ian in the studio, almost 50 years to the day that you had done it in London. I mean, for a start, that 50 years seems to me quite incredible, that anybody could sort of do two things 50 years apart. What did it mean to you to be back there on the rostrum with this particular piece?
Well, I wanted to do it with you in a way I felt would be as near as we could in the particular circumstances in which it was played, as near as possible, the way that I felt the music. And I remember saying to you at the time, when you first broached the subject of doing it together, and I said to you, Chris, you'll have to understand, I want to conduct this myself.
George, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Chris. Was trying to express the drama through the voice, not just through something in the orchestra. In fact, I think that, or it may have been Frank Hauser, one of those critics at the time when Ian was played, they noticed that I was delineating the character of the part by the actual melodic line. This was what I was seeking to do. I was trying to get the meaning and the character into the vocal line, not just some expressive sound coming out of the orchestra with the voice declaiming it. I was developing that way, and that's what I'd hoped to do.
Unfair question, perhaps, but perhaps there's an interesting answer. Are there parts of Iannin that you would want to revise, look at again in the view of your later experience?
Well, I don't think I could rewrite it. When we did it together with the BBC, Chris, I had to study it very, very deeply, because I have to study my own works as if they were somebody else's works. So I started really studying that, and I thought, oh my God, this is sin, you know, why do I just have these poor, a very wretched accompaniment or something, you know, because I've been writing so much more richly for the orchestra since then. Oh, this is terrible. But after a while, I said, no, don't touch it. Leave it absolutely as it is, because it had, at least I think it has a sort of freshness, which can only come from a young, inexperienced person. There are things I know you can look at it and say, well, that's not very well handled and the orchestra's not very good, but I've never changed it. The only things from the original score, when it went into production, we found there were certain little places at Penzance, we found, we'll cut out three bars there, because when somebody's coming in, just goes on. There were a few little places like that, and we changed all those. Eventually I tidied up the score. And when I came to study it with you, the score was precisely the same, except for some dynamics. I'm always changing the dynamics, and that's a natural thing to do, because the sound of the orchestra has changed so much. The modern orchestra is so different to what it was in 1934.
What's your favourite thing in this score, the passage you're most proud of?
Oh, my goodness, I shall have to think about that. Well, I rather like the whole end. I think the end of it has a certain sort of magic. And so I'm rather, I like that.
Did that come to you wandering among the stones?
So much of it did, yes, yes. I really lived and breathed this opera, you know, in a way perhaps I've never done with anything else. It was really part of me, and all that very unconsciously, which I think gives a certain vivacity and a certain something to it.
Truth.
Certain truth, yes, yes, perhaps that's it. And that you can't find again. When you reach my advanced age, it's gone.
Well, I was coming to that, George, because it must have been knowing what a lot of people know of what you've gone through since writing and doing Iannin for the first time, the disappointment at Covent Garden, the disaster of the war, the health problems after the war and the problems surrounding John Sockman and your eventual virtual retirement from the musical scene. You came back, you surprised the musical world, delighted the musical world. You came back in the late 60s, early 70s, and brought back something from pre-war England that we'd all forgotten about. And then this, for me, wonderful thing that you came back to direct Iannin, to conduct Iannin in the studio almost 50 years to the day that you had done it in London. I mean, for a start, that 50 years seems to me quite incredible, that anybody could sort of do two things 50 years apart. What did it mean to you to be back there on the rostrum with this particular piece?
Well, I wanted to do it with you in a way I felt would be as near as we could in the particular circumstances in which it was played, as near as possible, the way that I felt the music. And I remember saying to you at the time, when you first broached the subject of doing it together, and I said to you, Chris, you'll have to understand, I want to conduct this myself.
George, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Chris.